sorry. Due to heavy calling, we cannot complete your call at this time. Will you please hang up and try your call again later? If your call is urgent, please try again now.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this steamy Wednesday evening here in New York. It's 7 p.m. on a Wednesday, time for what we do every week. Kyle's here as well.
I am.
And out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
We have Alex.
Good evening.
And we have enough. That's okay. Wow. Is everybody comfortable? I'm not. You might hear it in my voice. I'm a little baked here, not in the good way.
Well, you may hear in our background that the AC is on and pumped up. So, you know, we're doing what we can for the air, but we need air too.
Yeah, yeah. Alex?
Well, I think I'm the only one in Manhattan at this particular moment. And it has just been pouring cats and dogs here. So that might be coming over towards you, Rob and Gila and Emmanuel and Kyle any moment. So you might hear that.
You know,
yeah,
Alex,
we are getting thunder.
Because of the decimation of NOAA and various other agencies, I haven't gotten a good weather forecast in months. Literally, when they say a shower is coming, it doesn't come. Or when they say it's going to be nice, it rains. So what you said just now is extremely valuable, because what you are is an individual, and individuality is all we have left. So it's going to take all of us sticking our heads out the window and saying, is it raining? Is it not? And telling the rest of us to get us through this thing so that we can have weather forecasts again, because we don't have it anymore. We just don't have it. And God help us when hurricanes start coming. All right. So we've been fighting technology, as we always do. We love it. We love fighting technology. It's so much fun. Alex, you just had some fun today with Gmail, didn't you? You found out your mailbox was full.
Yeah, I found out from you. Apparently, that's something that doesn't work either. So,
because you said, how come nobody sent me email? And I sent you email. So I did not take kindly to being referred to as nobody. So I said, I looked at mail logs, because I can do that. I can look at mail logs. When you run your own server, you can look at mail logs. And I saw that a message I had sent to you had been rejected by Gmail because the recipient's mailbox is full. But the thing is, apparently Gmail doesn't tell the recipient that their mailbox is full. Or if they do, maybe they email them. And because their email box is full, that message never gets to them. I don't know. I don't know how it got full. I'm getting warnings from one of my Gmail accounts saying, and it's all spam from Gmail, and I'm not going to do their work for them and weed out all their crap. I ignore it, and I'm going to continue to ignore it and use them as little as possible.
Yeah, it was a pretty awful experience. I just thought you guys were ignoring me. And I mean, I'm just
Oh no, we were ignoring you. That's no, yeah. don't let this go to your head and make it seem like we were engaged. No. But in this particular case, there was an email sent to you. It was, you know, I didn't get a bounce. I didn't get notified. I had to look at those logs. You can't do the same thing as a Gmail user. You can't look at logs and say, hey, what happened to that message that I sent to a distant server someplace? You know, what was its fate? I was able to see the fate of the message to you. I hope you didn't miss many messages.
Well, I don't use that email address for very many things anymore. So I probably didn't. So it's a very old email address that I've had from Gmail for over 20 years now. But yeah, it is full. I didn't get any notification from Gmail that it was going to be full. At least I don't think I did. And if they did, they probably emailed me about it as it was, or after it was at capacity. So fairly idiotic situation that I had to deal with. But I'm glad to see that I wasn't entirely ignored.
Well, Kyle and I, we had a bit of an adventure with technology. We were trying to watch a film. And, you know, it's a simple thing for most people, but for us, it becomes very complicated because we always are doing things in ways that are different than what we're supposed to be doing. In this particular case, we had a Blu-ray, and it was Region B. Region B is not the region we're in. We're in Region A. Just like for DVDs, we're in Region 1. We're always the first, no matter what. So Region B is mostly for Europe. Region 2 for DVDs, also for Europe. So anyway, we have a region-free DVD/Blu-ray player. So this isn't a problem for us.
This is actually one of several. You've had a DVD player that was region-free, and then you got a Blu-ray one that was region-free.
Yeah, they tend to break.
Yeah, they change the media. But it wasn't so much that we were fighting it. I think it was that, you know how you figure out like what the trick is to something?
Right.
It was remembering that.
Well,
because it comes with instructions.
It comes with instructions. We never remember where we put the instructions. We find the instructions after a while, and then we read the instructions and follow the instructions, and they don't work. And that was the problem we were facing. A half hour trying to get this thing to get out of the region that it was previously in, because we had watched something from a different country and we were in a different region, and it seemed to have gotten stuck there. And no matter what we did, we were following the instructions. We went online, talked to Gemini, artificial intelligence, and got ChatGPT involved. And they all had, you know, suggestions, but they weren't working. That was the big problem.
And I think we mutually recollected there was a trick beyond the instructions, and it was probably this very same scenario entirely. It's just, what exactly did we have to do? And I think it stems from the thing itself going into a state that's other than sort of on or off, like maybe a standby or something in the software itself of the player.
Yeah, turning off the Blu-ray player isn't enough. That doesn't reset it. You have to unplug it. And how long do you have to unplug it for? That's a question, too. That's open to debate by great minds. And we were trying all of that. Eventually, we got to the point where we were able to put the disc in. Well, actually, no, close the tray without the disc being in, unplug it, wait 30 seconds, plug it back in, open the tray, and there was some point where it involved not having the disc anywhere near the machine. That seemed to be key, because once we introduced the disc later, it suddenly saw it. And that was not suggested by any website, by any artificial intelligence being out there. It was just kind of like a hunch that we have to do it this way, and we can't let this touch that, and we have to wait, and we have to pray. And yes, it worked.
Well, it also involves putting a disc in from that previous region.
I think we had to go back to the previous region, yes.
Because of the state it was left in, it was like, okay, we didn't deliberately like turn it off and unplug it and put it in a drawer. It was just left however it was left after watching something. But, and then this old region. It needs to confirm what region it was in, and then before you like go through the process of changing
it. Now this is a region-free player, so it's meant to do this, but it wasn't working. And eventually we were able to trick it into. But it's something that we bought completely legitimately. You know, this is a legal thing to have, but we are trained as consumers to believe that this is the way it should be. Of course, you can't watch something from Europe in the United States. You know, you have to wait for it to come out in the United States, but you can't buy it in Europe and bring it over here. No, that's for some reason, and this goes back to the early days of DVDs. In fact, I was in court over this, where they wanted to control very, very strictly how people were able to view DVDs. The whole thing is so absurd and crazy. We've always had this problem. Even going back to videotapes, we had PAL, NTSC, CCAM, different formats. But those were actually different video formats. The video signal was different. Here, it's artificial. It's completely artificial. They do it because they can. Now, there is an economic reason for this. When you release a film, you release it at different times in different parts of the world. So, yeah, it probably makes sense that you not have it be able to be played in a different country if it's already on DVD in a second country. But, you know, I don't know many films that are being released on the big screen while they're on DVD in other countries. But whatever, you know, they can have that. But I think what they should do is implement something where after a certain amount of time, it just works everywhere. And don't tell me that's not possible. They can't figure out how to do that. Of course they can do that. So, okay, the film comes out the first 6 months, you can restrict how people watch it on media. And then after that, it becomes part of the collection of films. Yeah, you're still buying it, you know, you're still renting it or whatever it is people do these days. And then you're able to see whatever you want to see. You can buy something overseas, you can get a different region, and not feel like you're breaking the law or have wasted your money or anything like that.
Well, it's this, yeah, the workaround being this this source of aggravation. And in that process, you start questioning, what is the point of this? It shouldn't be a workaround that I have to suffer and remember and understand the quirks and idiosyncrasies of this whole mechanism. It should be that the player itself just reads all of it natively without switching anything.
It's designed to.
That's let alone have a button on a remote or something.
But that is what the device is for. We have this big piece of hardware that is designed to play the zeros and ones that are on that particular disc. And there is something, some routine in there that tells it, no, don't do that. Prevent that from happening. Do exactly the opposite of what you were put on Earth to do. And we'll just have to dance in circles and figure out how to make something work. So it was ridiculous that we had to spend all this time with devices that we legally purchased to see something that has been out since, what, 1980?
Man, it looked really good.
Who were they protecting? I don't understand it.
Once we got to actually enjoying it, it was
so worth it.
Spectacular.
It was so worth it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, since you asked, The Elephant Man by David Lynch. It's incredible. In black and white, it looks incredible. It was worth every moment of torture we had to go through. I've heard people say that.
Kind of fitting, too, that you have to go through an ordeal to watch it.
It shouldn't be this way. It really shouldn't be. It's never been this way with audio. You know, imagine CDs, different regions. Imagine a vinyl with different regions. You couldn't play, you know, a British version of an album in the United States because it's a different region. And of course, you can't do that. You know, it's very easy to be trained to believe something is normal. And it's actually absurd. And I think we should ask ourselves this, particularly with technology. You know, are we doing something that makes absolutely no sense just because we're told to by people with lots of money? Question everything. And we as hackers can figure out a better way. Gila, go ahead, and then Rob.
I mean, I was going to say, don't speak that into existence, because if somebody hears you say it, they'll be like, oh, that's a really good idea. Region-specific CDs coming soon.
Do you really think that has a snowball's chance in hell of surviving at this late stage? I don't know.
It's funny that you both talk about CDs, though, because there was an instance where Sony Music tried to produce CDs, or what they called CDs, but they were not standard audio CDs with easily accessible Redbook audio, like the standard says you have to make. They had an extra layer of DRM, and were meant to prevent you copying them and doing all sorts of things. But it also meant that a lot of legitimate CD players could not read the data on there. And so not only consumers, but the industry as a whole said, no, Sony, you can't do that. And they basically got bitten about it and had to back off and go back to producing regular CDs.
I do feel sorry for them because of the losses they have suffered in the years since that. You know, that they've fallen apart, they've gone bankrupt. Yeah, this really hurts them. I'm my heart bleeds. Ugh. Okay, so anyway, we have other things to talk about tonight. You know, one thing that's happened is that listener mail has piled up. So we're going to try and get through some of that tonight. And you can add to the pile by writing to us, oth@2600.com. That's our email address. And our mailbox will never fill up, Alex, because we control the size of it ourselves. All right. Let's see. In regards to the talk of ICE and raids and things like that, Tony writes, who are the obscured immigration agents? Well, because they're always covering themselves with masks. You don't know who they are. I would suspect that they've hired outside contractors in many roles for these arrests. The three percenters and other similar movements have been awfully quiet. These are the militia-type people. Perhaps they found a new hobby, working as contractors for immigration. Would it not make sense to compare silhouettes against known folks in those circles? Well, that's an interesting thought, and makes me kind of feel like, you know, law enforcement here or Big Brother, and I don't really want to go down that road either. All I know is when you go around wearing masks and doing things that intimidate people, you don't land on the right side of history. You generally do not, and we in the present ought to figure out what's actually going on and who's actually behind it. But you also raise an intriguing point. Yeah, they're hiring. They're hiring all kinds of people. Has anyone out there looked into getting hired by them, seeing the kinds of questions that they're asking, or the kind of people they're looking for? I'm not saying get hired. Be careful, because they'll hire you in a second. I'm sure they're desperate. But I am curious, you know, what their bar is, if they have a bar, and how they're asking, what circles they're moving in. You know, every bit of information is power. So anything we can find out, and we have so many intelligent people out there that can analyze and process information and trends and things like that, we shouldn't be intimidated. We should be thinking this is something we deserve to know. We have every right to know. And when we know it, we share it, because that's how hackers work. So good thoughts there. Good ideas. Okay, what else we have? Okay, this, maybe you can help me with this. This concerns YouTube. We do Overtime, which follows this show from 8 o'clock on Channel 2600 on YouTube. And there we are not constrained by radio rules, and we take phone calls and have all kinds of other discussions as well. I'd like to share a specific episode of Off the Hook, and I assume you mean Off the Hook Overtime, with my mates at the local group of computer volunteers here in Italy. It's the episode from the 3rd of March, 2025, where Jason Scott from the Internet Archive is interviewed. I would have preferred to share the video from YouTube, but it's not video either. I don't want to scare people, since this includes captions. Even if these are also in English, it would also help to understand those who are not conversationally proficient. However, even if the playlist for Off the Hook on YouTube indicates there are 71 episodes available, I can only see the first 10 of them, and the message appears that 61 videos are unavailable, and they're hidden. Could it be possible to make those previous episodes available? From Kudo. You know, I'm in the dark on this because I don't pay any attention to what's going on YouTube, and I don't think our show is archived on YouTube. Maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. I know, Gilly, you've got your hand raised high, so why don't you just correct everything I've said that's wrong so far?
It's not everything you've said that, but weirdly enough, so Off the Hook Overtime absolutely lives on YouTube. And imagine my surprise when last week I found that there are currently episodes of this particular program available on YouTube. However, it's only about the last 10, kind of like on Spotify or something. So right now, yeah, it says there are 61 unavailable videos that are hidden. Now, as not an owner of the channel, I don't know how much more I can learn about this particular situation. But yes, apparently this is a podcast that lives on channel 2600, and there are 10 episodes right there.
Yeah, so, this happens because YouTube themselves grab podcast feeds and convert them into YouTube videos. And that's what's going on here. If you search on YouTube for Off the Hook Podcast, which I know sets your teeth on edge, Emmanuel, you'll see this feed that that the person who wrote to us is referring to. And yeah, it only holds on to the last 10 episodes. It is not a permanent archive. If you want a permanent archive of Off the Hook as it goes out over the radio, you can always find that on our site, 2600.com/offthehook. That is the way to share it with your pals.
Now, okay, but he raises a good point, or she raises a good point, that there are captions. And we don't have captions on our local storage, but it's kind of a nifty feature to have if it's automatically generated. So I can understand why people would want to have that and see it on YouTube. So, okay, I stand corrected. Our shows are also on YouTube. Why aren't all of our shows on YouTube? Because, people have videos on YouTube. They have thousands of them. We should have more than 10. What's making them fall off?
That is a very good question, and I guess it would speak to how it works when YouTube pulls these things down. I can tell you, like, Gil and I work on podcasts apart from Off the Hook, mm-hmm. and we have it actually set up on a channel we control to pull them in on YouTube, and that holds on to them, the best I could tell. So it must be something to do with, like, claiming the podcast feed as your own and gaining some measure of control of it over there. But I don't know enough about this to say for certain.
And that's pretty much where we usually wind up turning the car off and getting out, because we know something about the technology. We don't know everything about it. We don't have time to get completely engrossed in it. So if somebody out there has tips they can send us as to how to do this better, you know, we're all ears. We'd like to do that because we want our material to be available. We always have it stored on our own servers, but we don't mind if it's on YouTube as well, as long as they don't throw commercials onto everything. I know that their captions, Google has this kind of puritanical view of words, and they block out certain words. I think there's a way to turn that off as a creator, but not as a viewer or listener. So those kinds of things, that rubs us the wrong way as well. But we're definitely open to this. And if anybody has a method of creating captions, we'd love to do that for all of our previous shows as well. But, we don't have hours to spend to do that ourselves. If there's some AI solution to this, we'd love to know about it. Yes, Rob.
It's interesting that you mentioned the censorship issue, because that is a really important consideration in the automatic captions on YouTube. I was doing some looking into this a while back and found that in terms of accessibility, basically, even things that are allowed to have swears in it, we can't do that on the radio, but you can look up plenty of things on YouTube that are full of adult language, but YouTube's automatic captions will refuse to translate them into something viewable. So if you're a person who can hear the audio, yeah, you can absorb all the swears you want, but if you're a person who needs the captions, you don't get to have the swears. You could look up famous songs by, like, Rage Against the Machine that have very famous choruses that we cannot say on this radio program. But on the official uploads, on the music videos, you can listen to the song, you can hear all the swears. If you're reading the captions, it will say, censored you. I won't do what you tell me.
Hold on a second. All right, this is starting to annoy me here. We understand where the FCC is coming from. It's been that way for a long, long time. We can't say certain words. We proved it right here on this radio station. But Google does not own the content that you upload to YouTube. You own that content. They have no right to tell you what words you can and cannot use. So who are they to suddenly block out words they deem objectionable? Oh, sure, I'm sorry. The answer is probably we have to protect the children. It's not about the children. Not all content is for children. In fact, there's even a checkbox saying this content is not for children. How are they able to get away with censoring language? Gila?
So, yes, I have a lot to say about this. I was listening actually to a YouTube creator I appreciate a lot talking about self-censorship in a way that has crept into a lot of creator stuff, between TikTok and YouTube, there are things that get demonetized if there are certain words that are heard, and you know, they won't give them to kids under 18, which also often means that things get demonetized. That can be a really, it can be a death knell for a creator in a lot of ways. And since none of the stuff on Channel 2600 is in fact monetized, thank you. So that is less of a concern here, obviously. But when you hear people who refer to things like grapes and sewer slides and things of that nature, this whole second language that has come in to replace actual regular words that we need to use to converse as human beings, I think it's an infantilization of the world in general under the guise of protect the children, which we're dealing with in so many ways. And it's not like they're not going to hear it if they don't hear it on YouTube.
Yeah, but hold on a sec, what we're forgetting here is that it's there in the video. You know, you could mm-hmm. go, you can make a video on YouTube, use every profanity you can imagine in different languages, whatever. You can just go off for an hour if you want, and people will hear it. Children will hear it, but they won't be able to read it on the text. Whose idea is this? Who is that protecting?
And this is a huge issue in the world of accessibility. I've worked in the field of making media alternatively accessible for people with certain needs. And there has been a longstanding tendency, even in terms of like captions for TV shows and movies and things, to sort of infantilize the disabled. The deaf community, you know, doesn't get to have those swears because on some level, the general consensus of the media industry seems to think that they couldn't handle the swears as if they were not adults who, you know, can use language just as the rest of us do. And it's a huge problem.
Wow. Okay. Well, you just gave me an idea. If the if members of the hearing impaired community can come together, maybe a class action suit could be launched because this is discriminatory behavior. Where you're not allowing people to see what is actually being said that other people who are not hearing impaired can hear. You know, why is that? Why are they being treated differently? It's I never even thought about it this much until we started talking about it. I didn't realize that it was that much of an issue. But this is, you know, it's another example why we shy away from using other services, because they do stupid things like this. It's fine to have the content there. We're all about sharing, and it's not about monetizing. And, you know, if I can say anything to creators, if they still listen to us at all, it's not about the monetization. Yeah, it's nice to you know, get a 75-cent check or whatever from Google, but that shouldn't be the reason why you do what you do. You do what you do because it's you, and you want to create something. You want to express yourself in a particular way, and if people appreciate that, that's people speaking, not big corporations, and they will play by your rules. So, just don't let yourself get manipulated by small checks, because that's all it's going to be. It's going to be tiny checks, you know, unless you go viral, and then okay. But then, you know, if you go viral, you can set your own terms anyway. So you really have the freedom, no matter what, to do things the way you want to do things. And I hope people do that. All right, we have one more letter. I'm going to get this a little bit longer, so let's spend a little bit of time on this. It's about Signal, actually. This came in a few weeks ago. We wanted to clear up some things concerning your comments about the Signal app. There are two major issues where we think there are misunderstandings. One is that a message is marked as delivered, even if the contact no longer has Signal, and that Signal does not deactivate accounts from their server. Okay. On the first point, contrary to what was said on the show, Signal does not mark a message as delivered to a contact if that contact no longer has Signal. Okay, I think the phrasing is what's important here, but let's continue. If there is only one check mark on a message, that means the message was only delivered to the Signal servers and is now waiting to be delivered to the contact's phone or a desktop client. If there is no Signal client for the server to deliver the message has nowhere to go and remains on the server waiting to be delivered. Messages do not sit on the server forever. They're deleted after a set time if never delivered, or immediately deleted from the server after delivery. While the message is on the server waiting to be delivered, the one check mark will remain as the status of the message on the sender's phone. There have to be two check marks for a message to have a delivered to contact status. And then there are two filled in check marks. That means the message was read by the contact, which only happens if that option is activated for both the sender and the contact. So if someone sends a message to a contact who no longer has signal, the message will never have two check marks. If one only sees one check mark, the sender can assume the contact is either temporarily offline, maybe in a subway, or ran out of data on their phone, or their phone is turned off. Or after an extended period of time, if only one check mark remains, like weeks or months, that contact no longer has signal. But nonetheless, with only one check mark, the sender will know at least the contact has not received the message yet. For those with disappearing messages on, depending on the timing of the disappearing message, it's possible the sender could see the message disappear from their own device, only ever seeing one check mark, and not know if the message was delivered, if ever, after the message disappeared off their own device. But we won't get into that. If a person deregisters their account before uninstalling the app, which hopefully they did, the server will mark the account as inactive. And if someone tries to send that contact a message, they will see a notice along the lines of "this contact is not / no longer a Signal user," or "this person isn't using Signal." I think the second one is better because, you know, that's telling some information about the person if they ever were a Signal user. The problem, of course, is if someone breaks or loses their phone, it gets stolen, or they simply uninstall Signal without deregistering first. I think that's what we were talking about. In these scenarios, there is no way for Signal to know that information. And Signal, of course, would not want to deregister someone who is away for an extended period of time, whether they're digitally detoxing, temporarily in the hospital, or something else. And needs to give some leeway on how long before kicking someone off the server. But Signal does keep track of the last time a device connected to the server. So for a desktop client connected device, those get deactivated after 30 days of inactivity. One's phone, though, since it's the primary device, gets deactivated from the server after 180 days. It used to be a year. So to recap, in the worst case scenario, if a contact no longer has Signal for whatever reason, the sender will perpetually see only one check mark on the message indicating it was not delivered to the contact yet. And then after no more than 180 days, they will know for sure the contact no longer uses Signal. Hope this is helpful and the information can be shared with your radio audience. And yes, it is helpful, and it's pretty accurate, I think. But the problem comes, and I think this is what we were discussing, is that many people don't get rid of Signal in the right way. They simply stop using it. They don't deactivate their account. So what happens is you send somebody a message and it will go to that particular app, which the person is not checking, and that particular app will say, "Okay, I received it." Doesn't mean the person read it. You won't see the filled in check marks. But as mentioned, not everybody has that feature. So the problem is not with Signal so much as with the rules that are involved with this type of technology, where you still can receive messages even if you're not using the app. And there's no way to really tell if you're using the app or not. How do you do that? It's an impossible situation. I know that. But it still leads to all kinds of problems. For instance, there have been many instances I know of where I've been sending people messages, never hearing back from them, and I found out later they were using a different messaging app and not checking their Signal app, or their phone was lost and that had the signaling app on it. And that's a huge security issue if somebody just lets their phone fall into some other a person's hands, or loses track of it in some other way, or it gets stolen. You have to deactivate your Signal account or regain control of it somehow to lock that person out. A lot of people don't do that. It's about education. It's about knowing what kind of security you need to implement for your own privacy. And many times, we don't do a good enough job. I've seen other people, you know, when I say, you know, you never respond to my signal message, they open signal at that point, and they're all my messages. They're seeing them for the first time. You know, and that's certainly not the ideal way to use that service. And, you know, it's a great service. It works. You know, just the other day, I got put onto a Signal chat. And it's a very talkative Signal chat. And all of a sudden, all my Signal alerts, which, by the way, are custom. I can customize my audio. I like doing that for different apps. And Signal makes that very easy. But I was getting 100 of them a minute. It was ridiculous. I had to turn it off. I had to mute that one particular conversation, or at least change the alert tone. It was so easy to do that, as opposed to almost every other app I work with. It was so incredibly simple to simply modify that so that it wouldn't bother me. It would sound different or not sound at all. And that's the kind of configuration we need to be able to have access to. Alex.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing I'll say about Signal is that, you know, unlike email, it doesn't fill up. Unless your device is filling up, you can continue to get instant messages. They're not going to charge you on the basis of how many messages you have coming through your device. I mean, I like this notion of end-to-end encrypted messaging being used for chats that are timely, relevant, maybe chats that would be about, let's say, like a radio show that happens every week instead of email. You know, especially a show about hacking and hackers and things like that and technology, maybe a Signal chat could be a way of communicating going forward, as opposed to using a deprecated system like email.
Okay, first of all, who are you to deprecate email?
A user that was totally screwed over today by email.
Because you weren't paying attention to what Google was trying to tell you, even though they didn't actually try. No, it's right. I'm trying to take Google's side for
once.
It
wasn't an email, it was Gmail.
It was Gmail. Yeah, Gmail is not email. I want to say that.
Or Fmail.
It just Fmail?
Oh, okay. You didn't know about that?
No. But look, email is different than Signal or texting. It's a different form of communication. You can't replace one with the other, you know? And not everybody wants to use that. Email is much more versatile, and it goes across many, many different platforms. And you don't have to use one particular service.
I still disagree. I think using email is silly. We've had so many problems with this with email, not just inboxes filling up, but emails disappearing, emails being filtered out.
Yeah, but that's bad habits. That's why we have problems with, because of bad habits.
Certainly, it's email filtering systems that, you know, assume the worst with respect to, let's say, a new domain name that you might register or something like that. So there's all these problems that we don't necessarily have solutions for, because it requires having access to certain technology or appliances that are outside of our control and that are centralized somewhere else. I mean, it's all well and good if you run your own mail server over there manual, but
I believe others should do as well, or there should be more people running it for people who can't do it themselves. Because I'll tell you, I use a mail reader called Mutt on a Linux machine, and I don't have any of these problems. And it's just so efficient and fast to communicate. And when I'm using texting or Signal or anything, it's not nearly as fast or efficient or easy to go back and look something up. For instance, you know, one thing that I really, you know, I know a lot of people like this this feature where you can erase something that you said in the past. Well, you know, I'm a party to the conversation. I don't want you erasing our conversation. I want to have that conversation. I want to be able to look back on that conversation. I don't want people meddling and editing the past. But, you know, I know when you're doing all kinds of cloak and dagger things, and, you know, you want your security to be preserved, it's essential. It's different reasons for having these different applications.
Well, I mean, look, it's an issue of privacy, too. I mean, the thing about email is it's not end-to-end encrypted it's just not end-to-end encrypted. I mean, the email goes over in clear text. I mean, we can use PGP, but that becomes a nightmare with any kind of, with multiple parties in an email chain.
It's been 150 years. Haven't we come up with something besides PGP by now? I mean, seriously.
No.
Yes, we have end-to-end encrypted messaging apps like Signal that we could use, you know, instead for chats that are much better. Well,
fine. Then why can't that be used for email?
It's a key management issue, really. I think. But unless you have something else, I think a good segue here, though, when we're talking about technologies that are used to preserve privacy, perhaps I'd love to address what I saw today in court in the Southern District of New York, if that's a good time to talk about this.
Well, it sounds like you're about to be taken to court, but okay, go ahead. Let us know what's going on.
I very well may. And I think this is an incredibly important case that really the mainstream media and I think a lot of the hacker culture has not really.
Really, Alex? What are you, in the street? What's going on over there?
I don't understand why every time I start talking or I'm on an important phone call, it's like there's an ambulance that seems to be stuck underneath. I'm 9 floors up right now as well. So it's not like I'm at the ground floor.
Well, let me explain how sound works. It goes in all directions. Doesn't matter how many floors up. You can be on top of the Empire State Building. You're still going to hear sirens.
You can still hear sirens, but it's so piercing. It goes through the windows. It goes up. It just refracts from building to building. It's really something
and
crazy.
And you've shared it with the entire metropolitan area now. But please.
Well, that's right. This
continue before the next one comes.
So in any event, I think this is an extraordinarily important case that is of great relevance to both the open source community and the hacker community. I'm talking about the Tornado Cash case. And a lot of people like to be dismissive of anything that has to do with cryptocurrency or blockchains. But and so let me give you a little bit of background here. Tornado Cash is a decentralized cryptocurrency privacy protocol that uses smart contracts and allows users to obfuscate transactions on a blockchain. It makes them harder to trace, right? It gives you something that would be known as financial privacy. Everything on a blockchain is open, it's public, it's on a ledger, and nobody would want to see, nobody would want their bank account to be completely open and public if you're making lots of transactions on the blockchain. So this issue of trying to solve for financial privacy is really, really difficult. So how do you do this? So somebody came up with...
Can I just ask you, Alex, before you continue, why wasn't that done in the first place? Because that seems so intuitive that you wouldn't want your whole... Kyle, you have the answer for that?
No, I'm just trying to find out. Is this a so-called mixer of cryptocurrencies that takes stuff that's attributed on the ledger to one person and mixes it through other transactions?
Well, you leapfrogged over my question, but okay, fine. Alex,
I was just participating in the conversation, right. But
yes, yeah. Well, as you are allowed to do, Kyle, you know, and in a sense, you're right, Kyle. It's kind of like a mixer. What it does is it pools transactions together, so it's very difficult to see, you know, what currency belongs to what particular person or what transaction belongs to what particular person after it's gone through this pool in Tornado Cash. And it's a completely open source project. It was started in 2019 in Boston at a hackathon. And all of the cryptographic underpinnings, the supporting toolchains, everything's been open source since the protocol's inception. It's been available for review and used by pretty much everyone. And this open source nature of Tornado Cash is really central to its operation as a decentralized privacy protocol. It works on Ethereum and other blockchains. The user interface and code repositories are all hosted publicly, and the project is governed by a DAO, or a decentralized autonomous organization. So there's a lot of implications here to the hacker community and to the open source community. As I promised, let's dive into the stratigraphy here. So there's significant legal implications here for software developers, because what has happened here is that the developer Roman Storm was charged by the U.S. Department of Justice for money laundering, for sanctions violations, and for unlicensed money transmission. Now, these are charges for an open source software developer that could carry around 20 to 25 years in prison if he's convicted on all of these charges. The closing statements were today. And so this case right now in the Southern District of New York before Judge Fiala is with the jury. We could have a verdict in this tomorrow. But the problems here are very, very big, because the legal implications for software developers in the open source community, especially those creating privacy tools or protocols that can be used for lawful or potentially unlawful purposes. So the core legal questions here are whether developers, builders, hackers can be held criminally liable for writing code that they release as open source if other people subsequently use that code for illegal acts. like money laundering, sanctions evasion, and we were talking about Signal and things before. Signal today came up in the defense's closing statement because this is an end-to-end encrypted application that's used by drug mules and drug lords and bad guys and all these, nefarious individuals.
Hey,
and criminals.
I use it too, you know.
And you use it. That's a good case in point as well. But are we prosecuting the developers of Signal for creating a tool that is then used by bad guys? Because what happened here was that North Korea and the Lazarus Group in particular had used Tornado Cash to launder lots and lots of stolen digital assets, stolen cryptocurrency. And the government's case was essentially that, well, these developers knew what they were doing when they deployed this to the Ethereum blockchain. They knew what they were doing. They had control over the code. They had control over the DAO. They had control over the user interface in the front end. And therefore, they should have taken measures to try to shut this down, even though they really didn't have that particular type of control. So there's going to be, I think, a lot of chilling effect here on the open source community, because being charged with these types of very, very serious crimes, essentially for writing code, is really terrifying here. And this is a case, too, that harkens back to the DCSS case that involved a certain hacker magazine, 2600, that was sued by the Motion Picture Association of America for publishing source code in its magazine that had to deal with the decryption of the content scrambling system that was found in DVDs. I think you remember exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of Jan Johansson, who was in that very situation. He wrote the software and was being faced with possible charges because some people might have used it, even theoretically, not actually, might have used it in a bad way.
Absolutely. So this is a case that really has the same exact legal principles at play in the DCSS case that involved 2600. Now we go back 26 years later, because I think that case started in 1999, if I recall correctly. I remember you being on the stand in 2000. And actually, that's how I know how old you are, because I remember you had to state your age while you were on the stand, and everybody gasped audibly in the audience. Nobody knew how old you were at that point. So
I don't think there was an audible gasp in the courtroom. I don't think anybody cared.
Well, from where I was sitting, I heard some gasps, but that's neither here nor there. That won't be reflected in the transcript either. But in any event, the issue, though, is this notion of source code and writing code being free speech. Is this something that's protected by the First Amendment? That was like an issue that was squarely at play in your case. And the court in your case, which was Universal Studios v. Ramirez, that was the caption of it, came down and said, well, look, it has to do with the purpose of the code. And because the purpose of that code was to decrypt DVDs, it didn't really have strong First Amendment protection afforded to it. But if you take the inverse of that now and you say, okay, well, here's this developer 25, 26 years later who created privacy-enhancing technology so that people's transactions could be secure and away from prying eyes on the blockchain, and then it's misused by all these bad guys, is that now protected by the First Amendment? Should it be?
Yeah, you're leaving out one important detail. We lost our case.
You did lose your case. Yes, right. Yeah, and it really had to do with an injunction. You went up to the Second Circuit. I remember I was there. This is one of the cases that really cemented my desire to go and become a lawyer. And 5 years later, I was a member of the bar. So, but it's the same exact legal principle. In fact, your case was cited in the briefs that had to deal with whether or not this indictment should have been dismissed.
Wait, I'm in that court now? Really?
Maybe you should be.
Wow. No, I mean my name. I mean, the case was being cited?
Yeah, the case was cited in the briefs. And when the court denied the motion to dismiss the indictment, your case was cited. Because it's being alleged that the primary purpose of this particular source code was really to evade sanctions and to facilitate money laundering and all these other things. And it didn't have to do with privacy. But how can we allow something like Signal or even WhatsApp, let's say, right? Meta owns WhatsApp. They create end-to-end encrypted messaging applications that the FBI cannot crack into, that law enforcement cannot crack into, and that's used by bad guys all the time. but yet we're prosecuting one open source programmer, one developer who faces over 20 years in prison if he's convicted on these charges.
I think it's different and distinct in that those are direct communications, but there are similarities in the structuring of how it's implemented with regard to the decentralization. And that actually comes back around to your question of why texting and person-to-person communications weren't implemented with the same level of encryption. But it's a choice that in the financial sense allows the transactions to be direct and not rely on any kind of centralization, whereas Signal does have a centralized system, I believe. So.
We are going to have to continue this conversation on overtime, and it's a good reason for people to join us in overtime. Go to YouTube. Go to YouTube. It's we don't endorse YouTube, but sometimes it's a useful vehicle for us. And enter channel 2600, or just click on the link that's on top of the 2600.com webpage, and you can listen to more of this chit-chat and maybe even join us with a phone call.
And support community radio and WBAI as much as possible, and we'll see you again very, very quickly,
buddy,
in short order.
buddy.wbai.org or give to wbai.org. And I believe, Rob, you have a reminder for us as well?
I do. 2600 meetings are happening all over the world this Friday. Check out 2600.com/meetings, nyc2600.net for the local one here in New York.
Okay. Alex, you know, one final thing. Last week I played an outro. It was called Four Electronic Dogs by one Laurie Anderson. And you did not care for that, I believe, is the expression you expressed rather vehemently. So I've done my penance, and I've come up with another Laurie Anderson song that I hope you like better.
It's cacophonous. It was cacophonous last week.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what some people might say, but I don't say that. I don't say that at all. And this is for you. Good night, everyone.
Beispiele paranormale Tonbandstimmen. Was sind paranormale Tonbandstimmen? Es sind Stimmen unbekannter Herkunft. Es sind paranormale Tonbandstimmen.
Ihren Klang. Ich verstehe die Sprachen.
Shining slowly.
Ich höre nur
birds are flying.
Ihren Klang.
So low. Honey, you're my one and only, so pay me what you owe me. The lights are going down slowly, in the woods the animals are moving. In my dreams you're talking to me, your voice is as if you knew me, so pay me what you owe me.
A confident parent, so destiny. 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 A confident parent, so destiny.
Beispiel Nummer 22.